with Bugliosi framing the whole case. Kenrick had only one question for Mrs. Chapman, but it was a good one. Had she ever seen the defendant Charles Manson before her appearance in court? She replied that she had not. Although he had recently married and was not anxious to leave his bride, William Gerritsen had flown back from his home in Lancaster, Ohio, where he had returned after being released by LAPD. The former caretaker came across as sincere, though rather shy. Although I intended to call both officers Wiesenhunt and Wolfer, the former to testify to finding the setting on Gerritsen's stereo at between 4 and 5, the latter to describe the sound tests he had conducted, I did question Gerritsen in detail as to the events of that night, and I felt the jury believed him when he claimed he hadn't heard any gunshots or screams. I asked Gerritsen, "How loud were you playing your stereo?" Answer, "It was about medium. It wasn't very loud." This, I felt, was the best evidence Gerritsen was telling the truth. Had he been lying about hearing nothing, then surely he would have lied and said the stereo was loud. Most of Fitzgerald's questions concerned Gerritsen's arrest and alleged rough handling by the police. At one point later in the trial, Fitzgerald would maintain that Gerritsen was involved in at least some of the Tate homicides. Since there wasn't even a hint of this in his cross-examination, I'd conclude that he was belatedly looking for a convenient scapegoat. Kenrick again asked the same question. "No, he'd never seen Manson before," Gerritsen replied. When I'd interviewed Gerritsen prior to his taking the stand, he'd told me that he still had nightmares about what had happened. That weekend, before his return to Ohio, Rudy Altabelli, who was now living in the main house, arranged for Gerritsen to revisit 10,050 Cielo Drive. He found the premises quiet and peaceful. After that, he told me, the nightmares stopped. By the end of the day, we had finished with 3 more witnesses: Frank Guerrero, who had been painting the nursery that Friday; Tom Vargas, the gardener, who testified to the arrivals and departures of the various guests that day, and to his signing for the 2 steamer trunks; and Dennis Hurst, who identified Sebring from a photograph as the man who came to the front door when he delivered the bicycle about 8 that night. The stage was now set for the prosecution's main witness, whom I intended to call to the stand first thing Monday morning. On hearing my opening statement, Manson must have realized that I had his number. At the conclusion of court that afternoon, Sheriff's Deputy Sergeant William Maupin was escorting Manson from the lockup to the 9th floor of the jail when, to quote from Maupin's report, "Inmate Manson stated to undersigned that it would be worth $100,000 to be set free. Inmate Manson also commented on how much he would like to return to the desert and the life he had before his arrest. Inmate Manson commented additionally that money meant nothing to him, that several people had contacted him regarding large sums of money. Inmate Manson also stated that an officer would only receive a 6-month sentence if caught releasing an inmate without authority." Maupin reported the bribe offer to his superior, Captain Alley, who in turn informed Judge Older. Though the incident was never made public, Older gave the attorneys Maupin's report the next day. Reading it, I wondered what Manson would try next. Over the weekend, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten lit matches, heated bobby pins red hot, then burned X marks on their foreheads, after which they ripped open the burnt flesh with needles to create more prominent scars. When the jurors were brought into court Monday morning, the X's were the first thing they saw, graphic evidence that when Manson led, the girls followed. A day or so later, Sandy, Squeaky, Gypsy, and most of the other family members did the same thing. As new disciples joined the group, this became one of the family rituals, complete to tasting the blood as it ran down their faces. July 27th to August 3rd, 1970. 8 sheriff's deputies escorted Linda Kasabian from Sybil Brand to the Hall of Justice through an entrance that circumvented those patrolled by the family. When they reached the 9th floor, however, Sandra Good suddenly appeared in the corridor and screamed, "You'll kill us all! You'll kill us all!" Linda, according to those who witnessed the encounter, seemed less shaken than sad. I saw Linda just after she arrived. Though her attorney, Gary Fleischman, had purchased a new dress for her, it had been misplaced and she was wearing the same maternity dress she'd worn when pregnant. The baggy tent made her look more hippie-like than the defendants. After I'd explained the problem to Judge Older, he heard other matters in chambers until the dress was located and brought over. Later, a similar courtesy would be extended to the defense when Susan Atkins lost her bra. Bugliosi. The people call Linda Kasabian. The sad, resigned look she gave Manson and the girls contrasted sharply with their obviously hostile glares. Clerk, would you raise your right hand, please? Kenrick, object, Your Honor, on the grounds this witness is not competent and she is insane. Bugliosi, wait a minute. Your Honor, I move to strike that, and I ask the court to find him in contempt for gross misconduct. This is unbelievable on his part. Unfortunately, it was all too believable. Exactly the sort of thing we had feared since Kenrick came on the case. Ordering the jury to disregard Kenrick's remarks, Older called counsel to the bench. There is no question about it, Older told Kenrick. Your conduct is outrageous. Bugliosi, I know the court cannot prevent him from speaking up, but God knows what he is going to say in the future. If I were to say something like this in open court, I would probably be thrown off the case by my office and disbarred. Defending Kenrick, Fitzgerald told the court that the defense intended to call witnesses who would testify that Linda Kasabian had taken LSD at least 300 times. The defense would contend, he said, that such drug use had rendered her mentally incapable of testifying. Whatever their offer of proof, Older said, matters of law were to be discussed either at the bench or in chambers, not in front of the jury. As for Kenrick's outburst, Older warned him that if he did that once more, I am going to take some action against you. Linda was sworn. I asked her, Linda, you realize that you are presently charged with 7 counts of murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. Answer, yes. Kenrick objected, moving for a mistrial. Denied. It was some 10 minutes later before I was able to get in the second question. Question. Linda, are you aware of the agreement between the district attorney's office and your attorneys that if you testify to everything you know about the Tate-LaBianca murders, the district attorney's office will petition the court to grant you immunity from prosecution and dismiss all charges against you? Answer. Yes, I am aware. Kenrick objected on 4 different grounds. Denied. By bringing this in first, we defused one of the defense's biggest cannons. Question. Besides the benefits which will accrue to you under the agreement, is there any other reason why you have decided to tell everything you know about these 7 murders? Another torrent of objections from Kenrick before Linda was able to answer. I strongly believe in the truth, and I feel the truth should be spoken. Kenrick even objected to my asking Linda the number of children she had. Often he used a shotgun approach. Leading and suggestive, no foundation, conclusion and hearsay, in hope that at least some of the buckshot would hit. Many of his grounds were totally inapplicable. He would object to a conclusion, for example, when no conclusion was called for, or yell hearsay when I was simply asking her what she did next. Since I'd anticipated this, it didn't bother me. However, it took over an hour to get Linda up to her first meeting with Manson, her description of life at Spawn Ranch, and over Kenrick's very heated objections, her definition of what she meant by the term family. Answer. Well, we live together as one family, as a family lives together, as a mother and father and children. But we were all just one, and Charlie was the head. I was questioning Linda about the various orders Manson had given the girls when, unexpectedly, Judge Older began sustaining Kenrick's hearsay objections. I asked to approach the bench. Laypeople believe hearsay is inadmissible. Actually, there are so many exceptions to the hearsay rule that many lawyers feel the law should read, hearsay is admissible except in these few instances. For example, Susan Atkins' confessions to Virginia Graham and Ronnie Howard were hearsay, but admissible under the admission exception to the hearsay rule. I told Older I had anticipated many legal problems in this case, and I have done research on them, because I kind of play the devil's advocate, but I never anticipated I'd have any trouble showing Manson's directions to members of the family. Older said he sustained the objections because he couldn't think of any exception to the hearsay rule that would permit the introduction of such statements. This was crucial. If Older ruled such conversations inadmissible, there went the domination framework and our case against Manson. Shortly after this, court recessed for the day. Aaron, J. Miller Levy, and I were up late that night looking for citations of authority. Fortunately, we found two cases, People v. Fratiano and People v. Stevens, in which the court ruled you can show the existence of a conspiracy by showing the relationship between the parties, including statements made to each other. Shown the cases the next morning, Judge Older reversed himself and overruled Kenrick's objections. Opposition now came from a totally unexpected direction. Aaron. Linda had already testified that Manson ordered the girls to make love to male visitors to induce them to join the family. When I asked her, "Linda, do you know what a sexual orgy is?" Kenrick immediately objected, as did Hughes, who remarked in a somewhat revealing choice of words, "We are not trying the sex lives of these people, we are trying the murder lives of these people." Not only were the defense attorneys shouting objections, many of which Older sustained, Aaron leaned over to me and said, "Can't we skip this stuff? We're just wasting time. Let's get into the two nights of murder." "Look, Aaron," I told him sotto voce, "I'm fighting the judge, I'm fighting Kenrick, and I'm not going to fight you. I've got enough problems. This is important, and I'm going to get it in." As Linda finally testified, in between Kenrick's objections, Manson decided when an orgy would take place. Manson decided who would and who would not participate, and Manson then assigned the roles each would play. From start to finish, he was the maestro, as it were, orchestrating the whole scene. That Manson controlled even this most intimate and personal aspect of the lives of his followers was extremely powerful evidence of his domination. Moreover, among the 20-some persons involved in the particular orgy Linda testified to were Charles Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Leslie Van Houten, and Patricia Krenwinkel. The sexual acts were not detailed, nor did I question Linda about other such group encounters. Once the point was made, I moved on to other testimony. Helter Skelter, the Black-White War, Manson's belief that the Beatles were communicating with him through the lyrics of their songs, his announcement late on the afternoon of August 8, 1969, that now is the time for Helter Skelter. Describing her appearance on the stand, the Los Angeles Times noted that even in discussing the group's sex life, Linda Kasabian was surprisingly serene, soft-spoken, even demure. Her testimony was also at times very moving, telling how Manson separated the mothers and their children, and relating her own feelings on being parted from Tanya. Linda said, "Sometimes, you know, when there wasn't anybody around, especially Charlie, I would give her my love and feed her." Linda was describing Manson's directions to the group just before they left Spawn Ranch that first night when Charlie, seated at the council table, put his hand up to his neck and with one finger extended made a slitting motion across his throat. Although I was looking the other way and didn't see the gesture, others, including Linda, did. Yet there was no pause in her reply. She went on to relate how Tex had stopped the car in front of the big gate, the cutting of the telephone wires, driving back down the hill and parking, then walking back up. As she described how they had climbed the fence to the right of the gate, you could feel the tension building in the courtroom. Then, the sudden headlights. Answer. and a car pulled up in front of us, and Tex leaped forward with a gun in his hand. And the man said, "Please don't hurt me, I won't say anything." And Tex shot him 4 times. As she described the murder of Stephen Parent, Linda began sobbing, as she had each time she had related the story to me. I could tell the jury was moved, both by the mounting horror and her reaction. Sadie giggled. Leslie sketched. Katie looked bored. By the end of the day, I had brought Linda to the point where Katie was chasing the woman in the white gown, Folger, with a knife, and Tex was stabbing the big man, Frankowski. He just kept doing it and doing it and doing it. Question. When the man was screaming, do you know what he was screaming? Answer. There were no words. It was beyond words. It was just screams. Reporters keeping track of Kennerick's objections gave up on the third day when the count passed 200. Boulder warned Kennerick that if he interrupted either the witness or the prosecution again, he would find him in contempt. Often a dozen transcript pages separated my question and Linda's answer. Bugliosi, we are going to have to go back, Linda. There has been a blizzard of objections. Kennerick, I object to that statement. When Kennerick again interrupted Linda in mid-sentence, Older called us to the bench. The court. Mr. Kennerick, you have directly violated my order not to repeatedly interrupt. I find you in contempt of court, and I sentence you to 1 night in the county jail starting immediately after this court adjourns this afternoon until 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. Kennerick protested that, rather than my interrupting the witness interrupted me. By day's end, Kennerick would have company. Among the items I wished to submit for identification purposes was a photograph which showed the straight Satan's sword in a scabbard next to the steering wheel of Manson's own dune buggy. Since the photograph had been introduced in evidence in the Beausoleil trial, I didn't get it until it was brought over from the other court. The district attorney is withholding great quantities of evidence from us, Hughes charged. Bugliosi. For the record, I just saw it for the first time a few minutes ago myself. Hughes, that is a lot of shit, Mr. Bugliosi. The court, I hold you in direct contempt of court for that statement. Though in complete agreement with Older's earlier citing of Kennerick, I disagreed with his finding against Hughes, feeling if he was in contempt of anyone, it was me, not the court. Two, it was based on a simple misunderstanding, one which, when explained to him, Hughes quickly accepted. Older was less understanding. Given a choice between paying a $75 fine or spending the night in jail, Hughes told the court, I'm a pauper, Your Honor. With no sympathy whatsoever, Older ordered him remanded into custody. Kennerick learned nothing from his night in jail. The next morning he was right back interrupting both my questions and Linda's replies. Admonishments from the bench accomplished nothing. He'd apologize, then immediately do the same thing again. All this concerned me much less than the fact that he occasionally succeeded in keeping out testimony. Usually when Older sustained an objection, I could work my way around it, introducing the testimony in a different way. For example, when Older foreclosed me from questioning Linda about the defendants watching the news of the tape murders on TV the day after those murders occurred, because he couldn't see the relevance of this, I asked Linda if, on the night of the murders, she was aware of the identities of the victims. Answer, no. Question, when was the first time you learned the names of these 5 people? Answer, the following day on the news. Question, on television? Answer, yes. Question, in Mr. Spahn's trailer? Answer, yes. Question, did you see Tex, Sadie, and Katie during the day following these killings, other than when you were watching television with them? Answer, well, I saw Sadie and Katie in the trailer. I cannot remember seeing Tex on that day. The relevance of this would become obvious when Barbara Hoyt took the stand and testified, 1, that Sadie came in and told her to switch channels to the news, 2, that before this particular day, Sadie and the others never watched the news, and three, that immediately after the newscaster finished with Tate and moved on to the Vietnam War, the group got up and left. In my questioning of Linda regarding the second night, there was one reiterated theme. Who told you to turn off the freeway? Charlie. Was anyone else in the car giving directions other than Mr. Manson? No. Did anyone question any of Mr. Manson's commands? No. In her testimony regarding both nights, there were also literally a multitude of details which only someone who had been present on those nights of horrendous slaughter could have known. Realizing very early how damaging this was, Manson had remarked, loud enough for both Linda and the jury to hear, "You've already told three lies." Linda, looking directly at him, had replied, "Oh no, Charlie, I've spoken the truth and you know it." By the time I had finished my direct examination of Linda Kasabian on the afternoon of July 30th, I had the feeling the jury knew it too. When I know the defense has something which might prove harmful to the prosecution's case, as a trial tactic, I usually put on that evidence myself first. This not only converts a damaging left hook into a mere left jab, it also indicates to the jury that the prosecution isn't trying to hide anything. Therefore, I'd brought out, on direct, Linda's sexual permissiveness and her use of LSD and other drugs. She had taken LSD about 50 times, she testified, the last time being in May 1969, 3 months prior to the murders. Prepared to destroy her credibility with these revelations, the defense found itself going over familiar ground. In doing so, they sometimes even strengthened our case. It was Fitzgerald, Krenwinkel's defense attorney, not the prosecution, who brought out that during the period Linda was at Spawn, I was not really together in myself. I was extremely impressionistic. I let others put ideas in me. And, even more important, that she feared Manson. Question. What were you afraid of? Fitzgerald asked. Answer. I was just afraid. He was a heavy dude. Asked to explain what she meant by this, Linda replied, he just had something, you know, that could hold you. He was a heavyweight. He was just heavy, period. Fitzgerald also elicited from Linda that she loved Manson, that I felt he was the Messiah come again. Linda then added one statement which went a long way toward explaining not only why she, but also many of the others, had so readily accepted Manson. When she first saw him, she said, I thought, this is what I have been looking for, and this is what I saw in him. Manson, a mirror which reflected the desires of others. Question. Was it also your impression that other people at the ranch loved Charlie? Answer. Oh, yes. It seemed that the girls worshipped him, just would die to do anything for him. Helter Skelter. Manson's attitude toward blacks, his domination of his co-defendants. In each of these areas, Fitzgerald's queries brought out additional information which bolstered Linda's previous testimony. Often his questions backfired, as when he asked Linda, "Do you remember who you slept with on August 8th? Answer, "No." Question, "On the 10th? Answer, "No. But eventually I slept with all the men." Time and again, Linda volunteered information which could have been considered damaging, yet coming from her somehow seemed only honest and sincere. She was so open that it caught Fitzgerald off guard. Avoiding the word orgy, he asked her regarding the love scene that took place in the back house, "Did you enjoy it?" Linda frankly answered, "Yeah, I guess I did. I will have to say I did." If possible, at the end of Fitzgerald's cross-examination, Linda Kasabian looked even better than she had at the end of the direct. It was Monday, August 3rd, 1970. I was on my way back to court from lunch, a few minutes before 2 p.m., when I was abruptly surrounded by newsmen. They were all talking at once, and it was a couple of seconds before I made out the words, "Vince, have you heard the news? President Nixon just said that Manson's guilty." August 3rd to 19th, 1970. Fitzgerald had a copy of the AP wire. In Denver for a conference of law enforcement officials, the president, himself an attorney, was quoted as complaining that the press tended to glorify and make heroes out of those engaged in criminal activities. He continued, "I noted, for example, the coverage of the Charles Manson case. Front page every day in the papers. It usually got a couple of minutes in the evening news. Here is a man who was guilty, directly or indirectly, of 8 murders. Yet here is a man who, as far as the coverage is concerned, appeared to be a glamorous figure." Following Nixon's remarks, Presidential Press Secretary Ron Ziegler said that the president had failed to use the word alleged in referring to the charges. On the way back to Washington on Air Force One, President Nixon issued a supplementary statement. "I have been informed that my comment in Denver regarding the Tate murder trial in Los Angeles may continue to be misunderstood despite the unequivocal statement made at the time by my press secretary. The last thing I would do is prejudice the legal rights of any person in any circumstances. To set the record straight, I do not now and did not intend to speculate as to whether the Tate defendants are guilty in fact or not. All the facts in the case have not yet been presented. The defendants should be presumed to be innocent at this stage of the trial." We discussed the situation in chambers. Fortunately, the bailiffs had brought the jury back from lunch before the story broke. They remained sequestered in a room upstairs, and so as yet, there was no chance of their having been exposed. Kenrick moved for a mistrial. Denied. Ever suspicious that the sequestration was not effective, he asked that the jurors be voir dired to see if any had heard the news. As Aaron put it, it would be like waving a red flag. If they didn't know about it before, they certainly will after the voir dire. Older denied the motion without prejudice, so it could be renewed at a later time. He also said he would tell the bailiffs to inaugurate unusually stringent security measures. Later that afternoon, the windows of the bus used to transport the jury to and from the hotel were coated with Bonami to prevent the jurors from seeing the inevitable headlines. There was a TV set in their joint recreation room at the Ambassador. Ordinarily, they could watch any program they wished, except the news, a bailiff changing the channels. Tonight, it would remain dark. Newspapers would also be banned from the courtroom, Older specifically instructing the attorneys to make sure none were on the counsel table where they might inadvertently be seen by the jury. When we returned to court, there was a smug grin on Manson's face. It remained there all afternoon. It isn't every criminal who merits the attention of the President of the United States. Charlie had made the big time. The jury was brought down, and Atkins defense attorney Day Shin began his cross-examination of Linda. Apparently intent on implying that I had coached Linda in her testimony, he asked, "Do you recall what Mr. Bugliosi said to you during your first meeting?" Answer, "Well, he has always stressed for me to tell the truth." Question, "Besides the truth I'm talking about?" As if anything else were important. Question. "Did Mr. Bugliosi ever tell you that some of your statements were wrong, or some of your answers were not logical or did not make sense?" Answer. "No, I told him. He never told me." Question. "The fact that you were pregnant, wasn't that the reason that you stayed outside the Tate residence instead of going inside to participate?" Answer. "Whether I was pregnant or not, I would never have killed anybody." Shin gave up after only an hour and a half. Linda's testimony remained unshaken. With a heavy, ponderous shuffle, Irving Kenrick approached the witness stand. His demeanor was deceiving. There was no relaxing when Kenrick was cross-examining. At any moment he might blurt out something objectionable. There was also no anticipating him. He'd suddenly skip from one subject to another with no hint of a connecting link. Many of his questions were so complex that even he lost the thought and had to have the court reporter read them back to him. It was excruciatingly tiring listening to him. It was also very important that I do so, since, unlike the two attorneys who preceded him, Kenrick scored points. He brought out, for example, that when Linda returned to California to reclaim Tanya, she told the social worker that she'd left the state on August 6th or 7th, which, had this been true, would have been before the Tate-LaBianca murders occurred. If accurate, this meant that Linda had fabricated all of her testimony regarding those murders. And if she had lied to the social worker to get her daughter back, Kenrick implied, she could very well lie to this court to get her own freedom. But mostly he rambled and droned on and on, tiring the spectators as well as the witness. Many of the reporters wrote off Kenrick early in the proceedings. Given a choice of defense attorneys, they quoted Fitzgerald, whose questions were better phrased. But it was Kenrick, in the midst of his verbosity, who was scoring. He was also beginning to get to Linda. At the end of the day, her sixth on the stand, she looked a little fatigued and her answers were less sharp. No one knew how many days of this lay ahead, since Kenrick, unlike the other attorneys, consistently avoided answering Older's questions about the estimated length of his cross-examination. On my way home that night, I was again thankful the jury had been sequestered. You could see the headlines on every newsstand. The car radio had periodic updates. Hughes, I am guilty of contempt for uttering a dirty word, but Nixon has the contempt of the world to face. Fitzgerald, it is very discouraging when the world's single most important person comes out against you. The most reported quote was that of Manson, who had passed a statement to the press via one of the defense attorneys. Mimicking Nixon's remarks, it was unusually short and to the point. Here's a man who was accused of murdering hundreds of thousands in Vietnam, who is accusing me of being guilty of 8 murders. The next day in chambers, Kenrick charged the president with conspiracy. The district attorney of Los Angeles County is running for attorney general of California. I say it without being able to prove it, that Evel Younger and the president got together to do this. If this was so, Kenrick said, he shouldn't be president of the United States. The court? That will have to be decided in some other proceeding, Mr. Kenrick. Let's stay with the issues here. I am satisfied there has been no exposure of any of these jurors to anything the press may have said. I see no reason for taking any further action at this time. Kenrick resumed his cross-examination. On direct, Linda had stated that she had taken some 50 LSD trips. Kenrick now asked her to describe what had happened on trip number 23. Bugliosi, I object to that question as being ridiculous, Your Honor. Though there is no such objection in the rule books, I felt there should be. Apparently Judge Older felt similarly, as he sustained the objection, as well as others when I objected that a question had been repeated ad nauseam or was nonsensical. Just after the noon recess, Manson suddenly stood and, turning toward the jury box, held up a copy of the front page of the Los Angeles Times. A bailiff grabbed it, but not before Manson had shown the jury the huge black headline, Manson Guilty, Nixon Declares. Older had the jury taken out. He then demanded to know which attorney, against his express orders, had brought a newspaper into court. There were several denials, but no one confessed. There was no question now that the jury would have to be voir dired. Each member was brought in separately and questioned by the judge under oath. Of the 12 jurors and 6 alternates, 11 were aware of the full headline. 2 saw only the words Manson guilty. 4 only saw the paper or the name Manson, and 1, Mr. Zamora, didn't see anything. I was looking at the clock at the time. Each was also questioned as to his or her reaction. Mrs. McKenzie, well, my first thought was, that's ridiculous. Mr. McBride, I think if the president declared that, it was pretty stupid of him. Miss Mesmer, no one does my thinking for me. Mr. Doubt, I didn't vote for Nixon in the first place. After an extensive voir dire, all 18 stated under oath that they had not been influenced by the headline and that they would consider only the evidence presented to them in court. Knowing something about jurors, I was inclined to believe them, for a very simple reason. Jurors consider themselves privileged insiders. Day after day, they are a part of the courtroom drama. They hear the evidence. They and they alone determine its importance. They tend very strongly to think of themselves as the experts, those outside the courtroom, the amateurs. As juror Dawson put it, he'd listen to every bit of the testimony. Nixon hadn't. I don't believe Mr. Nixon knows anything about it. My overall feeling was that the jurors were annoyed with the president for attempting to usurp their role. It was quite possible that the statement might even have helped Manson, causing them to be even more determined that they, unlike the president, would give him every benefit of the doubt. A number of national columnists stated that if Manson was convicted, his conviction would be reversed on appeal because of Nixon's statement. On the contrary, since it was Manson himself who brought the headline to the attention of the jury, this was invited error, which simply means that a defendant cannot benefit from his own wrongdoing. One aspect of this did concern me just a little. It was a subtler point. Although the headlines declared that Manson, not the girls, was guilty, it could be argued that as Manson's co-defendants, the guilt slopped over onto them. Although I assumed this would be an issue they would raise on appeal, I felt fairly certain it would not constitute reversible error. There are errors in every trial, but most do not warrant a reversal by the appellate courts. This might have, had not older voir dired the jury and obtained their sworn statements that they would not be influenced by the incident. Nor did the three female defendants exactly help their case when, the next day, they stood up and said in perfect unison, "Your Honor, the President said we are guilty, so why go on with the trial?" Older had not given up his search for the culprit. Dae-shin now admitted that just before court resumed, he'd walked over to the file cabinet where the bailiff had placed the confiscated papers and had picked up several and brought them back to the counsel table. He'd intended to read the sports pages, he said, unaware that the front pages were also attached. Declaring Shin in direct contempt of court, Older ordered him to spend 3 nights in the county jail, commencing as soon as court adjourned. We were already past the usual adjournment time. Shin asked for an hour to move his car and get a toothbrush, but Older denied the motion, and Shin was remanded into custody. The next morning, Shin asked for a continuance. Being in a strange bed and an even stranger place, he hadn't slept well the night before, and he didn't feel he could effectively defend his client. These were not all of his troubles, Shin admitted. I am now having marital problems, Your Honor. My wife thinks I am spending the night with some other woman. She doesn't read English. Now my dog won't even talk to me. Declining comment on his domestic woes, Older suggested that Shin catch a nap during the noon recess. Motion denied. Irving Kenrick kept Linda Kasabian on the stand 7 days. It was cross-examination in the most literal sense. For example, "Mrs. Kasabian, did you go to Spawn Ranch because you wanted to seek out fresh men, men that you had not had previous relations with?" Unlike Fitzgerald and Shin, Kenrick examined Linda's testimony regarding those 2 nights as if under a microscope. The problem with this, as far as the defense was concerned, was that some of her most damning statements were repeated 2, 3, even more times. Nor was Kenrick content to score a point and move on. Frequently, he dwelt on a subject so long he negated his own argument. For example, Linda had testified that on the night of the Tate murders, her mind was clear. She had also testified that after seeing the shooting of Parent, she went into a state of shock. Kenrick did not stop at pointing out the seeming contradiction, but asked exactly when her state of shock ended. Answer: I don't know when it ended. I don't know if it ever ended. Question. Your mind was completely clear, is that right? Answer. Yes. Question. You weren't under the influence of any drug, is that right? Answer. No. Question. You weren't under the influence of anything, right? Answer. I was under the influence of Charlie. Although Linda remained responsive to the questions, it was obvious that Kenrick was wearing her down. On August 7th, we lost a juror and a witness. Juror Walter Vitzelio was excused because both he and his wife were in ill health. The ex-security guard was replaced by lot by one of the alternates, Larry Sheely, a telephone maintenance man. That same day, I learned that Randy Starr had died at the Veterans Administration Hospital of an undetermined illness. The former Spawn Ranch hand and part-time stuntman had been prepared to identify the Tate-Sebring rope as identical with the one Manson had. Even more important, since Randy had given Manson the .22-caliber revolver, his testimony would have literally placed the gun in Manson's hand. Though I had other witnesses who could testify to these key points, I was admittedly suspicious of Starr's sudden demise. Learning no autopsy had been performed, I ordered one. Starr, it was determined, had died of natural causes, from an ear infection. Kenrick. Mrs. Kasabian, I show you this picture. Answer. Oh, God. Linda turned her face away. It was the color photo of the very pregnant and very dead Sharon Tate. This was the first time Linda had seen the photograph, and she was so shaken Older called a 10-minute recess. There was no evidence whatsoever that Linda Kasabian had been inside the Tate residence or that she had seen Sharon Tate's body. Aaron and I therefore questioned Kenrick's showing her the photograph. Fitzgerald argued that it was entirely possible that Mrs. Kasabian had been inside both the Tate and LaBianca residences and had participated in all of the murders. Older ruled that Kenrick could show her the photo. Kenrick then showed Linda the death photo of Wojtek Frykowski. Answer. He is the man that I saw at the door. Kenrick. Mrs. Kasabian, why are you crying right now? Answer. Because I can't believe it. It is just... Question. You can't believe what, Mrs. Kasabian? Answer. That they could do that. Question. I see. Not that you could do that, but that they could do that. Answer. I know I didn't do that. Question. You were in a state of shock, weren't you? Answer. That's right. Question. Then how do you know? Answer. Because I know. I do not have that kind of thing in me to do such an animalistic thing. Kenrick showed Linda the death photos of all five of the Tate victims, as well as those of Rosemary and Lino LaBianca. He even insisted that she handle the leather thong that had bound Lino's wrists. Perhaps Kenrick hoped that he would so unnerve Linda that she would make some damaging admission. Instead, he only succeeded in emphasizing that, in contrast to the other defendants, Linda Kasabian was a sensitive human being capable of being deeply disturbed by the hideousness of these acts. Showing Linda the photos was a mistake, and the other defense attorneys soon realized this. Each time Kenrick held up a picture, then asked her to look closely at some minute detail, the jurors winced or squirmed uncomfortably in their chairs. Even Manson protested that Kenrick was acting on his own. And still, Kenrick persisted. Ronald Hughes approached me in the hall during a recess. I want to apologize, Vince. No apology necessary, Ron. It was a heat-of-the-moment remark. I'm only sorry that Older found you in contempt. No, I don't mean that, Hughes said. What I did was a hell of a lot worse. I was the one who suggested that Irving Kenrick become Manson's attorney. On Monday, August 10th, 1970, the people petitioned the court for immunity for Linda Kasabian. Though Judge Older signed the petition the same day, it was not until the 13th that he formally dropped all charges against her, and she was released. She had been in custody since December 3, 1969. Unlike Manson, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten, she had been in solitary confinement the whole time. My wife Gail was worried. What if she goes back on her testimony, Vince? Susan Atkins did. Mary Brunner did. Now that she has immunity... Honey, I have confidence in Linda, I told her. I did. Yet in the back of my mind was the question, where would the people's case be if that confidence was misplaced? The next day Manson passed Linda a long handwritten letter. It seemed at first mostly nonsensical. Only on looking closer did one notice that key phrases had been marked with tiny check marks. Extracted, spelling errors intact, they read, "Love can never stop if it's love. The joke is over. Look at the end and begin again. Just give yourself to your love and give your love to be free. If you were not saying what you're saying, there would be no trial. Don't lose your love. It's only there for you. Why do you think they killed J.C.? Answer, 'cause he was a devil and bad. No one liked him. Don't let anyone have this, or they will find a way to use it against me. This trial of man's son will only show the world that each man judges himself.' Coming just after she had been granted immunity, the message could only have one meaning. Manson was attempting to woo Linda back into the family, in hopes that once freed, she would repudiate her testimony. Her answer was to give the letter to me. Though a number of people had seen Manson pass Linda the letter, Kenrick maintained that she had grabbed it out of his hand. The most effective cross-examination of Linda Kasabian was surprisingly that of Ronald Hughes. Though this was his first trial, and he frequently made procedural mistakes, Hughes was familiar with the hippie subculture, having been a part of it. He knew about drugs, mysticism, karma, auras, vibrations, and when he questioned Linda about these things, he made her look just a little odd, just a wee bit zingy. He had her admitting that she believed in ESP, that there were times at Spawn when she actually felt she was a witch. Question. Do you feel that you were controlled by Mr. Manson's vibrations? Answer. Possibly. Question. Did he put off a lot of vibes? Answer. Sure. He's doing it right now. Hughes. May the record reflect, Your Honor, that Mr. Manson is merely sitting here? Kenrick. He doesn't seem to be vibrating. Hughes asked Linda so many questions about drugs that had an unknowing spectator walked into court, he would have assumed Linda was on trial for possession. Yet Linda's alert replies in themselves disproved the charge that LSD had destroyed her mind. Question. Now, Mrs. Kasabian, you testified that you thought Mr. Manson was Jesus Christ. Did you ever feel that anybody else was Jesus Christ? Answer. The biblical Jesus Christ. Question. When did you stop thinking that Mr. Manson was Jesus Christ? Answer. The night at the Tate residence. Though I felt confident the jury was impressed with Linda, I was pleased to hear an independent evaluation. Hughes requested that the court appoint psychiatrists to examine Linda. Older replied, I find no basis for a psychiatric examination in this case. She appears to be perfectly lucid and articulate. I find no evidence of aberration of any kind insofar as her ability to recall, to relate. In all respects, she has been remarkably articulate and responsive. The motion will be denied. Hughes ended his cross-examination of Linda very effectively. Question. You have testified that you have had trips on marijuana, hash, THC, morning glory seeds, psilocybin, LSD, mescaline, peyote, methadrine, and romalar. Is that right? Answer. Yes. Question. and in the last year you have had the following major delusions. You have believed that Charles Manson is Jesus Christ, is that right? Answer, yes. Question, and you believed yourself to be a witch? Answer, yes. Hughes, Your Honor, I have no further questions at this time. The basic purpose of redirect examination is to rehabilitate the witness. Lyndon needed little rehabilitating other than being allowed to explain more fully replies which the defense had cut off. For example, I brought out that Linda meant state of shock figuratively, not medically, and that she was very much aware of what was going on. On redirect, the prosecution can also explore areas first opened on cross-examination. Since the theft of the $5,000 had come out on cross, I was able to bring in the mitigating circumstances, that after stealing the money, Linda had turned it over to the family, and that she neither saw it again nor benefited from it. Not until the re-redirect was I able to bring out why Linda had fled Spawn Ranch without Tanya. The delay in getting this in was actually beneficial, I felt, for by this time the jury knew Linda Kasabian well enough to accept her explanation. Direct, cross, redirect, recross, re-redirect, re-recross. Just before noon on Wednesday, August 19th, Linda Kasabian finally stepped down from the stand. She had been up there 17 days, longer than most trials. Though the defense had been given a 20-page summary of all my interviews with her, as well as copies of all her letters to me, not once had she been impeached with a prior inconsistent statement. I was very proud of her. If ever there was a star witness for the prosecution, Linda Kasabian was it. Following the completion of her testimony, she flew back to New Hampshire for a reunion with her two children. For Linda, however, the ordeal was not yet over. Kenrick asked that she be subject to recall by the defense, and she would also have to testify when Watson was brought to trial. Randy Starr was not the only witness the people lost during August. Still afflicted with wanderlust, Robert Kasabian and Charles Melton had gone to Hawaii. I asked Linda's attorney, Gary Fleischman, if he could locate them, but he said they were off on some uncharted island, meditating in a cave, and there was no way to reach them. I'd wanted Melton, especially, to testify to Tex's remark, "Maybe Charlie will let me grow a beard someday." The loss of the other witness was a far greater blow to the prosecution. Saladin Nader, the actor whose life Linda had saved the night the LaBiancas were killed, had moved out of his apartment. He'd told friends he was going to Europe, but left no forwarding address. Although I requested the LaBianca detectives to try to locate him through the Lebanese consulate and the immigration service, they were unsuccessful. I then asked them to interview his former landlady, Mrs. Eleanor Lally, who could at least testify that during August 1969, the actor had occupied apartment 501, 1101 Oceanfront Walk, Venice. But with Nader's disappearance, we lost the only witness who could even partially corroborate Linda Kasabian's story of that second night. On August 18th, however, we found a witness. One of the most important yet to appear. Over 7 months after I had first tried to get Watkins and Poston to persuade him to come in for an interview, Juan Flynn decided he was ready to talk. Fearful that he would become a prosecution witness, the family had launched a campaign of harassment against the tall, lanky Panamanian cowboy that included threatening letters, hang-up phone calls, and cars racing past his trailer in the night, their occupants oinking or shouting pig. All this had made Juan mad, mad enough to contact LASO, who in turn called LAPD. Since I was in court, Sartucci interviewed Flynn that afternoon at Parker Center. It was a short interview. Transcribed, it ran to only 16 pages, but it contained one very startling disclosure. Sartucci, When did you first become aware of the fact that Charles Manson was being charged with the crimes that he is presently on trial for? Flynn, I became aware of the crimes that he is being charged with when he admitted to me of the killings that were taking place. In his broken English, Flynn was saying that Manson had admitted the murders to him. Question. Was there any conversation about the LaBiancas, or was that all at the same time or what? Answer. Well, I don't know if it was at the same time, but he led me to believe. He told me that he was the main cause for these murders to be committed. Question. Did he say anything more than that? Answer. He admitted, he boasted, of 35 lives taken in a period of 2 days. When LAPD brought him to my office, I hadn't yet talked to Sartucci or heard the interview tape. So when, in interviewing Flynn, I learned of Manson's very incriminating admission, it came as a complete surprise. In questioning Juan, I established that the conversation had taken place in the kitchen at Spawn Ranch 2 to 4 days after news of the Tate murders broke on TV. Juan had just sat down to lunch when Manson came in and with his right hand brushed his left shoulder, apparently a signal that the others were to get out, since they immediately did. Aware that something was up, but not what, Juan started to eat. Ever since the arrival of the family at Spawn Ranch, Manson had been trying to get the 6'5" cowboy to join them. Manson had told Flynn, I will get you a big gold bracelet and put diamonds on it, and you can be my head zombie. There were other enticements. When first offered the same bait as the other males, Juan had sampled it eagerly, to his regret. That damn case of clap just wouldn't go away, Juan told me, not for 3-4 months. Though he had remained at Spawn, Juan had refused to be anybody's zombie, let alone little Charlie's. Of late, however, Manson had become more insistent. Suddenly Manson grabbed Juan by the hair, yanked his head back, and putting a knife to his throat said, "You son of a bitch, don't you know I'm the one who's doing all of these killings?" Even though Manson had not mentioned the Tate-LaBianca murders by name, his admission was a tremendously powerful piece of evidence. Legally, Manson's statement was an admission rather than a confession. An admission is a statement by a defendant which by itself is not sufficient to warrant an inference of guilt, but which tends to prove guilt when considered with the rest of the evidence. A confession is a statement by a defendant which discloses his intentional participation in the criminal act for which he is on trial and which discloses his guilt for that crime. The razor-sharp blade still on Juan's throat, Manson asked, "Are you going to come with me or do I have to kill you?" Juan replied, "I am eating and I am right here, you know." Manson put the knife on the table. "Okay," he said. "You kill me." Resuming eating, Juan said, "I don't want to do that, you know." Looking very agitated, Manson told him, "Helter Skelter is coming down and we've got to go to the desert." He then gave Juan a choice. He could oppose him or join him. If he wanted to join him, Charlie said, "go down to the waterfall and make love to my girls." Manson's "my girls" was in itself a powerful piece of evidence. Juan told Charlie that the next time he wanted to contract a 9-month case of syphilis or gonorrhea, he'd let him know. It was at this point that Manson boasted of killing 35 people in 2 days. Juan considered it just that, a boast, and I was inclined to agree. If there had been more than 7 Manson-ordered murders during that 2-day period, I was sure that at some point in the investigation we would have found evidence of them. 2, as far as the immediate trial was concerned, the latter statement was useless, as it was obviously inadmissible as evidence. Eventually, Manson picked up the knife and walked out, and Juan suddenly realized he didn't have much appetite left. I talked to Juan over 4 hours that night. Manson's admission was not the only surprise. Manson had told Juan in June or July 1969, while Juan, Bruce Davis, and Clem were standing on the boardwalk at Spawn, "Well, I have come down to it. The only way to get Helter Skelter going is for me to go down there and show the black man how to do it, by killing a whole bunch of those fucking pigs." Among Flynn's other revelations, Manson had threatened to kill him several times, once shooting at him with the .22